I'll turn to consolidated cases 24-8055, 8056, and 8057, American World Horse, Wild Horse Campaign versus Stone Manning. And I'll just say something personally to counsel here. We've had a lot of long, difficult, meaning challenging, well-argued cases. So just be tolerant of me. My younger colleagues probably are in good shape, but be tolerant if we're a little slow in absorbing stuff and make things as easy for us as possible.
We could take a break too if you want at some point.
I don't think that'll help. Then you guys will carry me anyway.
Good morning. William Eubanks for the AWHC petitioners. I'll be using 7 minutes to discuss the Bureau of Land Management's threshold authority to eliminate federally protected wild horse herds. I know it'll be difficult, but we're going to collectively try to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal. BLM's decision is a transparent attempt to rewrite the Wild, Free-Roaming Horses and Burros Act. The decision empowers BLM to terminate the protections that Congress afforded to the Great Divide Basin and Salt Wells Creek wild horse herds, abolishing their statutory safeguards for reasons having nothing to do with the ecological condition of these public lands. Lands that support these two herds on over 500,000 acres of solid block public lands outside the checkerboard. But in Loper Bright, the Supreme Court held that courts, not agencies, determine the best reading of statutes. Applied to the Wild Horse Act, BLM's action cannot be sustained because the agency exercised authority that Congress never gave it. The court must therefore reject BLM's decision as exceeding the agency's authority, just as another panel of this court did 9 years ago in AWHPC when interpreting many of these same provisions. Turning to the statute.
Judge McKay's recommendation in that case was erroneous.
Actually, as we've argued in our briefs, Judge McKay's position is consistent with our position in this case. What he said is that BLM should go back and consider excising the private lands and the resources located in the private lands in the checkerboard portions of these herd management areas, which is something that we do not object to. Had BLM done that, then we would not be here today, Your Honor, at least my client certainly would not be. But that's not what the decision before the court is. The decision under review is a much broader, much farther reaching decision in which BLM said, we're not just going to excise those private lands and resources, we're going to also terminate the protections for two wild horse herds and reduce the numbers of horses for another herd, the Adobe Town herd, for the public lands here, including large public solid block lands. And that is what BLM lacks the authority to do. And so I was the one who argued that case before Judge McKay. At the argument, the court certainly talked about the practical realities and talked about that in the opinion. But we think that what BLM did here is flatly inconsistent with what that court thought was the appropriate remedy. It did acknowledge that BLM was going to go back and look at these issues afresh, and it did. But the outcome of that process is not consistent with law, and the court was not opining on that at that time. That's why the AWHPC panel said the best way to deal with this is to take your concerns to Congress, because it's the statute that's the problem for BLM here.
Can't BLM, though, like rearrange the boundaries, the management boundaries that they, management areas that they want to manage because of, I think one of the problems with the horses has been overpopulation rather than too few of them. But anyway, shouldn't this be framed as simply we're redrawing the boundaries of the herd areas and the herd management areas?
Well, Your Honor, Judge Timkovich, it can't be characterized that way because that's not what the decision does. The clear import of this decision is that for the first
part of it does, right?
That is part of what
two of the four.
That is part of what, yeah. Right. But the other part of it, which is the piece that BLM lacks statutory authority from Congress to do, is to remove the threshold statutory safeguards that apply where Congress in Section 3A of the Act, 16 U.S.C. 1333A, said that wild horses must be protected and managed as components of the public land subject to the sole limitation that the protection and management must be consistent with a thriving natural ecological balance. That is the one exception that Congress created. BLM is not allowed to come in, no matter how compelling it is as a policy argument, and say there are other reasons that we want to tinker with those threshold congressional protections. That's what it's done here.
Aren't the herds within the new boundaries, don't they satisfy the natural balance requirement of the statute?
So the two herds that were eradicated as part of this decision, the Great Divide Basin and the Salt Wells Creek herds, those areas
are not eradicated, they're just not being managed.
Well, those lands, which for 54 years, since December 15th, 1971, have been consistently managed for wild horse use, will no longer be able to.
Before you come to those, in the new HMA, they are managed for natural balance.
All herd management areas are managed. That is the touchstone that Congress put in place. So yes, all of them are. But the two here that for the first time in the history of the Act have been removed for reasons having nothing to do with the ecological condition of the public lands, those will have no wild horse use going forward. This has never been done before by BLM, and this is an unprecedented and precedential decision. And so that's why we think this case starts and ends at step one of Loper-Bright. Section 3A, again, Congress was clear. Wild horses must be protected and managed as components of the public lands, and Congress sought to put one exception on that. Nothing about private lands, nothing about preventing straying, but only that it must be consistent with a thriving natural ecological balance. And to be clear, the record says those lands, the Great Divide Basin and Salt Wells Creek herd management areas, do currently provide a thriving natural ecological balance. That's at 2JA 54 and 2JA 84.
What is required by the statute, as you read it, that isn't included in the definition of a range? You seem to want a lot of management here, and it's not clear to me what more is done if this were declared to be a range, and there are like three or four ranges in the country, is that right?
Correct, Your Honor. Yes, we said three. So there are three or four ranges, depending on how they're characterized. Those are not at issue here. That's a special sanctuary where Congress afforded the discretion for BLM to say, we're going to take a herd management area, which is managed for multiple uses, including horses, and we're going to require these ranges, allow BLM to principally manage them for horses.
And what is involved there that you're not asking BLM to do at one of the HMAs, or even just if they're just horses on the land?
Sure. So how that happens in practice, again, it's not an issue in this case. We're not asking anything from BLM but to manage how it's always managed these areas. But for a range, there might be less off-road vehicle use, less oil and gas development, less livestock grazing because they're allowing additional resources to go to wild horses. But again, that is not an issue in this case. I see that I'm at the 7 minutes. I'd be happy to answer a few questions in rebuttal as well, unless Your Honors would like to. Thank you.
May it please the Court, I'm Jennifer Bess on behalf of Friends of Animals. I want to emphasize that this is a straightforward case about agency overreach, and I'd like to start with explaining how BLM violated the provisions of the Wild Free Roaming Horses and Burros Act that explicitly limit its authority to remove wild horses. The text of the Act is clear that BLM does not have authority to remove horses unless it first makes findings that both there is an overpopulation and that action is necessary to remove excess horses. The Act defines excess horses as those horses that must be removed to preserve a thriving natural ecological balance. It is undisputed here that horses do not need to be removed in order to preserve a thriving natural ecological balance.
Why is that argument right? That's their argument, isn't it? Rightness, that there's been no removal yet.
Yes, Your Honor. That argument is contrary to precedent and the administrative record. The standard for ripeness is not, is this the exact last final step? The standard for ripeness is whether the case is fit for judicial review and whether delay of review would prejudice petitioners. Both of those factors indicate that this case is ripe. First of all, whether it's fit for review. It's undisputed that this is a final binding decision. and that it requires the removal of wild horses. In fact, the record of decision itself explicitly says that the decision will permanently remove wild horses. And there are no additional facts that would assist the court in deciding this claim. Therefore, it is fit for judicial review and ripe. And in fact, other cases that have considered final land use plans have for wild horses have found that they were ripe when they were issued. For example, American Wild Horse Preservation Campaign versus Zinke. There's also Stout versus the U.S. Forest Service. There's two Friends of Animals cases that were kind of miscited by BLM in their briefs to claim that there wasn't jurisdiction. But in fact, both of those cases, what they cited was an interim order where the judges just asked for more information. And the final order in both of those cases found that, in fact, the plans were ripe for review. And
so what if they never get around to removal? That's my concern. I mean, it's hard to arrange these gathers. If they never do it, the horses are really never affected on those rangelands.
Well, on Your Honor, as a practical matter, they have already scheduled a removal to occur this July, and they have removed horses from this area several times before. So there's no question, and BLM itself
is that on public lands or on the private inholdings?
I'm talking solely about public lands here, and that's all this case concerns is public lands. This case does not concern any private lands. We are dealing with a decision that explicitly says this applies to BLM-administered public lands. And our argument is BLM does not have authority to remove horses from those public lands. We are not discussing its management on private lands. And private landowners still have the right to ask for horses to be removed from their private lands. What BLM does not have authority to do is to remove the horses from public lands for reasons unrelating to a thriving natural ecological balance. And this court, when it considered a very similar decision, it found that the practical realities of the checkerboard do not justify departing from the plain language of the act. And Judge McKay, in his own concurrence, starts out with saying that the text could not be more clear. BLM has to make these required findings. Then and only then can it remove excess animals. Here, BLM has made a final decision to remove animals without making those required findings. So it is clear that BLM has violated the law.
What is the minimal feasible level of maintenance of administration? What does that mean in this context?
Well, that's not directly at issue in this case, but I think that means that the management, the idea is that these horses should be wild. So there shouldn't be excessive management of the horses when it's not necessary. And that we.
Well, I'll be concrete about it. If it's minimal feasible in some sense, and let's just focus on the checkerboard area, and now you have a private landowner who's unwilling to have these animals on his property. So to police that, to respond to the demand that there not be any on that property, it's going to take a lot of management. And if you're supposed to have minimal management, then an easier way to deal with it is just not declare this area, this checkerboard area, as part of the RMA.
Yes, Your Honor, there is some discretion in the minimal feasible management, and that's, you know, what's minimal and feasible with also complying with the law. There is no discretion in BLM's obligation to protect and manage these horses for a thriving natural ecological balance. That is something that's required by the law, and that's something that BLM does not dispute was not driving their decision here. There is no dispute that this decision is not to maintain a thriving natural ecological balance, and there's no discretion to depart from that requirement.
The minimal feasible has nothing to do with that? They don't have to comply with that also?
Well, minimal feasible, there's some discretion. So if they're saying we have to remove from private lands, and then they can do that. If that's required, there's
what if it takes a lot of people? I mean, you're talking about every square mile has to be policed?
Well, as a practical matter, this has also come to the court many times, and I want to wrap up to give the other counsel time to argue.
That's your problem from trying to divide up your time, so I'm not real sympathetic.
Okay, so as a
question.
Yes, as a practical matter, this court has looked at the Wild Horse and Burrock many times and acknowledged, yes, it will impact private landowners. There's no requirement to prevent horses from straying onto private lands. And it is possible and it is likely that horses will stray onto private lands. There's no timing requirement under the Wild Horse and Burrow Act that they immediately remove them. There's no, there's some discretion there. It's not like we have to have an army.
Yeah, I get your point.
Yeah. There's not
how many horses will be left on the remaining HMAs? Under this decision?
Well, under the Salt Wells Creek HMA and the the Great Divide Basin HMA, there will be zero horses left under this decision.
How many are there now? In other words, how many total horses are there now and how many horses would there be if this went into effect?
So, first of all, we're talking about over 1 million acres of public lands here. And right now, the Adobe Town, the AML, is up to 800 horses. The Great Divide Basin, the AML, is up to 600 horses. And the Salt Wells Creek, the AML, is up to 365 horses. So we're talking about quite
1,000 horses?
Over 1,000 horses, yes. I would like to reserve some time for my...
Good morning, Your Honors. Bruce Wagman for the Return to Freedom petitioners. I'd like to address immediately Judge Hart's question about minimal feasible level of management because we did brief that. It is minimal feasible management. You can't manage no horses. And it's minimal feasible management on public lands, not private lands. We understand the issues of the checkerboard, but the minimal feasible management is BLM's directive on public lands. And you can't say, I'm going to manage by not managing anything. And that's what they've done here. So zeroing out the horses can't be enough. To Judge Timkovich's question, roughly 1,200 horses will be removed, 1,200 of the 2,100 that are there, with the turning the two HMAs into herd areas. So more than half in this giant area. BLM tries to ignore their management for minimal feasible management by requirement for minimal feasible management by zeroing out and then saying, now there's nothing left to do. But that's not the requirement that they have. I also wanted to touch briefly on NEPA. There's clearly a NEPA violation here because of a predetermined outcome. It's been no question for 10 years that the BLM has been intending to do what the ranchers wanted them to do. And that's in the record very clearly. We are going to get rid of the wild horses. We can't deal with it anymore. We can't deal with the complaints from the private owners. And so we're just going to end this. But that is not, as my colleagues have said, what Congress requires. They can't do it that way. That turns it into a predetermined outcome. And whether or not they went through the steps to show that they were complying with NEPA, the fact is they cannot do this kind of sort of sleight of hand and say, oh, look, we did it, but we really didn't do it. And this court has acknowledged that. In the Jewell case, and said, you have to look behind the curtain, if you will, to see what really was going on. And again, the record is replete with statements from the BLM. We are going to empty these areas because we can't deal with the complaints anymore. They do have to deal with the private landowners, but that's not part of the minimum feasible management of public lands and horses on those lands. Zeroing out has never been that. And as Mr. Eubanks said, they've never done anything like this in terms of turning herd management areas into herd areas. So the predetermined outcome issue sort of tanks this immediately, and I think the court should look very carefully at that. It set up the outcome before it did any work. It said, we're going to get rid of these horses, and then went into the NEPA process. That is just so transparent that it makes it clear what was going on here. They went through NEPA because they needed to act like they were going through NEPA. But they went through NEPA to cater to the ranchers, to cater to the private interests.
Wasn't there a no-action alternative?
There were several other alternatives. They put the alternatives on paper. But my point...
You're talking about their motives.
I'm sorry?
You're impugning their motives?
Their motives were clear that they were going to follow what the private ranchers wanted. That's been clear throughout when in their initial obeyance to the consent decree. despite the fact that the prior 10th Circuit Court said you, the consent decree is not enough, you still can't break the law. And so, yes, our contention is
there's... We're looking at the adequacy of the rod, aren't we?
I'm sorry?
We're looking at the adequacy of the explanation here.
Correct.
That's what you're challenging.
Absolutely. Because, again, it's in the record that BLM says over and over again, we're going to get rid of these horses. And going to get rid of these horses because of the private interests. And then it goes through the NEPA analysis. Right. So the NEPA analysis is there on paper, but behind all that is a predetermined outcome. And a predetermined outcome, it immediately vacates the NEPA analysis.
Did the district court make a finding on whether it was a predetermined outcome?
It did not.
Either way, it didn't say it wasn't predetermined, or it did say it?
I don't believe the district court made a finding on either in either way.
Was it argued?
I'm sorry?
Was it argued?
It was. District court? We have presented this throughout the case.
Because what's plain to you may not be plain to every reasonable fact finder. So I would have hoped that the district court would address it if it was clearly raised, but you're saying it didn't one way or the other.
It did not, and I would ask... I'm sorry. I would ask this court to look at it carefully because it is an important issue in this case. And the NEPA violations for us fold right into the Wild Horse Act violations. As Ms. Best said, the BLM is required to find that excess horses are on the land before they remove them. They did not do that. They're required to rely on science and rangeland conditions to determine the appropriate management level, the number of horses on the land. Instead, they just took an arbitrary number and said the number of horses is this for the two herd management areas they're still managing and zero for the ones that they are eliminating. So again, a straight violation of the Wild Horse Act in those two failures. And I'm going to stop now to reserve rebuttal time for my co-counsel unless there are other questions.
Good morning, or good afternoon, I think, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Ezekiel Peterson, here on behalf of the Bureau of Land Management. With me at council table is Danielle Betancourt, representing the intervenors Rock Springs Grazing Association, and Gregory Weiss, representing the intervenors State of Wyoming. My plan is to speak for 17 minutes, give or take, and turn over the rest of the 8-minute time for the intervenors to split. So I'd like to start by diving right into what BLM's statutory authority is for executing these resource management plan amendments. BLM took this action, it explains it, to JA 78 pursuant to FLTMA and pursuant to its duties under FLTMA to create these programmatic resource management plans that lay out how it will achieve multiple use management across public lands. FLTMA gives BLM at 43 U.S.C. section 1732A, it gives BLM overarching broad authority to balance appropriate uses for particular areas of public lands, including the authority to decide that certain lands should or should not be managed for certain other uses. The definitional provisions in FLTMA, that's at section 1702C of that same title, make it clear that multiple use management can mean managing some areas for less than all of the possible uses on those lands. So that was the specific statutory authority that BLM had to go back to step zero, just like this court suggested in Jewell, look at its programmatic resource management plan and determine that on the checkerboard lands, it wasn't appropriate to manage these lands for wild horses. Certainly,
there's discussion about a large chunk of this not being within the checkerboard.
Yes, Your Honor.
Why did anything have to be changed for that area?
So BLM made the findings in the record at 2JA83 that if horses were left in those solid block lands, they would continue to stray into the checkerboard. And BLM even considered an alternative B, which is at 2JA6566. BLM considered the idea of constructing a fence there to try and wall off those solid block lands, but it ultimately determined that doing so would interfere with mule deer habitat and mule deer migration corridors, as well as sage grouse that have leks or breeding grounds in the area. So it determined that that alternative was not feasible.
But that, That's true of any federal land. It's going to border private land at some point. Why is it such a problem? I can see that in the checkerboard with every square mile changing ownership. But if you've got a solid block, why is that so tough?
I think because...
And what distinguishes it from other solid blocks?
I think because the finding in the record at 2JA83 that in these particular solid block lands, the wild horses are close enough to the checkerboard and their range is large enough. Their range is 117 miles. They travel between 5 and 17.5 miles each day. That leaving horses in those solid block lands that are close enough to the checkerboard will invariably result in wild horses roaming back into the checkerboard lands. And then you're in kind of the same situation that you are otherwise. Still, the BLM looked at the different solid block lands that are in this area, and certainly in the Adobe Town HMA, there's an existing fence line in the Corson Springs allotment, and BLM explained that that creates some sort of natural barrier, or I guess unnatural barrier, so the horses won't be roaming back into the checkerboard lands, so that area could still continue to be managed for wild horses. So BLM looked at the intricacies of the management in these different areas and ultimately determined that some solid block lands in this area were suitable for wild horse management and some were not because the wild horses would roam back into the checkerboard. I want to address petitioner's argument about Section 3A of the Wild Horse Act. I think they take a really focused view of that particular statute, section of the statute, and argue that it precludes BLM from making any sort of changes to wild horse management absent some sort of ecological changes. But there's both a legal and a practical issue with that argument. The legal issue is that the statute doesn't actually say that. Certainly, it says that BLM should manage wild horses as a component of the public lands, and BLM recognizes that. In its wild horse management handbook at 5JA75, it recognizes that wild horses are treated as a component of the public lands, just like all the other uses, recreational uses, conservation uses, extractive uses, that are also balanced when BLM is doing land use planning. Section 3A also says that wild horses, when they are being actively managed, should be managed for a thriving and natural ecological balance. But it does not speak to this precursor programmatic land use planning step. It neither elevates wild horses above all other land management uses, nor does it subsume BLM's broad discretion under FLTMA to create these land use plans and determine which areas of land are suitable for which uses.
Well, shouldn't the government at least have said that by eliminating these two HMAs that there's been no negative effect on the natural balance of the herds, and it really didn't address, what was it, Salt Creek and the other one,
Adobe Town,
no,
or oh the one where it eliminated, where it reverted the HMA to the HA. Your Honor, there is evidence in
Great Divide and Salt Wells.
Great Divide and Salt Wells. There is evidence in the record, and this is at 2JA67, that having fewer wild horses on the range would benefit wildlife, soils, vegetation, livestock, and water resources, because there would be less forage being consumed on the range. The wild horses wouldn't be using up those resources that would otherwise be used. So that is in the record. Certainly, BLM didn't make a finding that this programmatic land use plan amendment would promote thriving natural ecological balance of wild horses, because it wasn't required to when making this step zero programmatic land use decision, that these areas, because of the land ownership patterns and the fact that RSGA has revoked consent to have wild horses on their land, that these areas were not suitable for wild horse management. I want to just address the practical reality.
Did it make a finding about the other remaining HMOs, Adobe and White Mountain?
It didn't make a finding about those. It left the White Mountain HMA as it was. That's something that changed from the draft environmental impact statement to the final. It left those as it was. As far as the Adobe Town HMA, it made the finding that leaving horses in that solid block land, as I discussed, the horses would roam back onto the checkerboard. But there was that boundary that allowed BLM to hold some wild horses on that solid block land. And at one moment. I believe it's 2JA8283. It explained how it proportionally reduced the number of wild horses on the Adobe Town HMA based on the proportional reduction of land area in the record of decision.
And just to restate as clearly as you can for my benefit, why managing salt wells and Great Divide to zero doesn't require some sort of finding that it won't negatively affect the natural balance of the horse population.
Because that finding only applies when BLM is actively managing wild horses in an area where it has determined in a land use plan is suitable for the management of wild horses. So when it's conducting gather operations.
But it has that now. Before the decision, it had that.
Yes.
And it took it away.
Yes.
Doesn't BLM have to explain that you're not negatively affecting their herd when you take away acreage?
No, because this is a programmatic land use plan decision under FLTMA. It's not a decision to manage wild horses under the Wild Horse Act. It's a decision that these lands are not suitable for wild horse management under FLTMA, which is something that under Section 1732A of FLTMA, BLM has the discretion to do.
I'm sorry, I just got to stop you. So 3A isn't a general requirement, is what you're saying. You can designate the land as appropriate without any restriction.
Well, there's restrictions in FLTMA.
Okay, yes. Right. But it nothing to do with the natural ecological balance of the horses.
That's correct, Your Honor. That applies when BLM is managing wild horses on public lands.
Okay.
And Section 3 certainly has to be read in concert with Section 4, which shows specifically that Congress didn't intend wild horses to be on private land, absent landowner consent, and that land ownership, therefore, was a key piece of the puzzle in where wild horses should be managed.
So that's why you agree with opposing counsel that you did not take the ecological balance into account.
That's,
you did not do that.
That's,
and you say you don't have to.
That's correct, okay. Your Honor. In the record, I think in the record of decision and in the EIS, BLM says we're not making this finding on the basis of a thriving natural ecological balance. We're making this finding on the basis that, you know, under FLTMA, which it says at 2JA78, under FLTMA, these lands aren't suitable for the management of wild horses. And I want to dive down briefly, at least, onto the practical realities of what plaintiff's construction of the act would result in. Plaintiffs would have the Wild Horse Act required BLM to maintain these HMAs indefinitely, absent some sort of ecological changes, which essentially means they admit that BLM could excise the private lands from the HMA, but they say, well, BLM can't excise the public lands from the HMA, absent some sort of ecological changes. But that would create thousands of one square mile, essentially mini HMAs, where these horses would constantly be straying onto private lands, and BLM would have to employ an army of staff to go out there, coax these horses back onto public lands, at which point the horses would immediately stray back onto private lands. And the whole process would start anew. BLM doesn't have the resources to do it. It doesn't have the staff to do that. And it's not required by the statute to have agents of the BLM going out there and literally playing checkers with these horses, moving them around from square to square.
The response was there's not a time limit on when they can remove the horses. So this can be done. You don't need to have an army of rangers out there to get the horses back off private land. You just do it when you get around to it.
Certainly under Section 4, there's a non-discretionary duty for BLM to do that. And we've seen a 40-year history, perhaps longer, of litigation over wild horses in this exact area, where not only have plaintiffs in this case been suing BLM over wild horse management, but also the ranchers have been suing BLM for not removing the wild horses in enough time. So that led to the consent decree.
There's been no judicial decision about how quickly they have to be removed.
I don't know if there's been a specific judicial decision about how quickly BLM has to comply with their Section 4 obligations, but there's certainly been litigation that's resulted in consent decrees and, I believe, judicial orders that BLM has to go and remove
Okay, so what do the consent decrees and the judicial orders say about the time allowed to get the horses out?
I don't have that information on hand, but perhaps counsel for the Rock Springs Grazing Association might. Just to briefly touch on the ripeness issues, the claim, we don't contest that petitioners here can raise claims against the RMP amendments and say those RMP amendments were procedurally improper or were promulgated in excess of statutory authority. But what they can't do is say that those RMP amendments are invalid because they didn't comply with procedures that BLM only needs to take when it is actively doing a gather, rounding up horses on public lands. That's essentially what Friends of Animals is arguing here, and that's what makes their claim unripe. BLM recognizes, and Judge Timkovich, I think this goes to what you were saying, BLM recognizes at 2JA 108, 109 that sometimes these gathers don't happen in time, sometimes there's financial constraints, so there is this further factual development that needs to occur before the court can drill down on whether BLM complied with its obligations in a specific gather plan that applied to a specific gather plan.
Can the plan be challenged at that stage?
The gather.
What they want to challenge is significant background, the backdrop for what they can do in removal. And if all you can challenge is the mechanism of the removal, you've got your hand tied behind your back at that point. Or can they challenge portions of the plan that relate to that, to the removal?
My understanding is that what they're challenging is that BLM, what they're attempting to challenge here is that BLM did not make the proper determinations that it must make when it makes an excess determination. They didn't make the proper ecological findings. And those are findings that BLM would make in future decision making, presumably through future gather plans that can then be challenged at that point because that's future final agency action. I think in that
they won't be precluded from making any of the arguments they're making.
They could be precluded from making the arguments about the propriety of the plan itself, the arguments we don't contest they can bring here, but not the specific ones about the gather plan. I think this case isn't meaningfully distinct from Ohio Forestry, which we said in a brief in that regard. I'm happy to answer any questions the court might have about the NEPA issues or the FLTMA issues here.
What about this preordained
argument?
Did the judge make any findings on that?
Yes, Your Honor. The judge found in the district court opinion at pages 60 to 63 that BLM did not predetermine its decision. We think that conclusion was right. I want to point especially to the fact at 2JA 80 that alternative D, which is the preferred alternative, changed meaningfully and substantively between the draft environmental impact statement and the final environmental impact statement to manage more wild horses on this area. I think that almost per se shows that there was no predetermination here because BLM was not irreversibly and irretrievably committed to a course of action. Rather, it took public comment into account during the NEPA process. It was flexible with its preferred alternative, and it adapted during that process.
And the judge made a finding to that effect?
The judge made a legal finding to that effect at page 60 to 63.
What do you mean by a legal finding?
It's a record review case, I suppose. It's all legal findings under the APA.
Well, if someone's motive is an issue, which is involved here, that's assessing the state of mind of the agency and what had been really determined, even though they tried to hide it. Did the judge make any finding about that?
The judge relied on the Forest Guardians case, which I think kind of gets at this. In that case, there were these extrinsic emails that certain agency staffers had sent that had showed some evidence of predetermination, where the email said, oh yeah, we're going ahead with this option. But this court in Forest Guardian said that's still not enough. You have to show, based on the record as a whole, that the agency was irreversibly and irretrievably committed to a certain course of action before it began that NEPA process.
And you can't divide up the course of action and say, well, maybe they weren't irreversibly committed with respect to the area that they eventually changed their mind on, but they are irreversibly.
I don't think that's enough to meet the very high bar of predetermination under NEPA. Unless this court has any further questions, we would ask this court affirm the district court and the agency decision. Thank you, Your Honors.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. I'm Danielle Betancourt with Rock Springs Grazing Association. We were interveners in the case below and support the BLM's decision in this case. I thought it would be helpful to kind of give a little background as well. I know it's in the prior case and the like, but only in short thrift in recognizing the fact that these herd management areas that are at issue right now really were only ever established and created at herd management areas based off of the agreement they were able to come with the landowners, including which was RSGA, the Rock Springs Grazing Association. And they agreed to allow 500 wild horses on their private lands across the checkerboard back in 1979. And, you know, it's been many years. They've tolerated these wild horses for a very long time. And I think it's also important to recognize the fact that, which is shown in the record at Volume 4, Joint Appendix 194, page 198 through 199, and 201, as well as 204, that talks about the fact that these areas would not have been herd management areas. The only way that they were ever designated was because of the fact that these wild horses could use the forage and resources on private lands. And a lot of portions of this were also really relevant, especially north of the checkerboard, which is part of the Great Divide Basin, the solid block above. Wasn't really appropriate for winter range for wild horses. So the wild horses come down into the checkerboard in the winter to graze a checkerboard and to graze private lands as well. And I think that is a big important issue to point out and things that are identified in the record. Another important thing is, and I think the government kind of hit on this, but is the fact, especially the checkerboard itself, what they're asking BLM to do is to manage only the public portions as HMAs. And by doing so, you would basically eradicate Section 4 out of the Wild Horse Act and not give the landowners any ability to ask removal of wild horses. Because there is no...
Isn't it a non-discretionary obligation of BLM to remove the horses when asked?
I would argue...
Under the statute, I mean, under 4.
It is, I mean, the case law has been very clear. It's not discretionary. It's a mandatory obligation that you have to remove wild horses upon landowner request.
That's what he is.
That's what I'm saying.
Oh, yes. Sorry. My apologies, Your Honor. And I would also point to the regulations. BLM has interpreted this as saying that at 43 CFR 4720.2-1 is that when they're notified about having wild horses on private lands, they have to do it as soon as practical. So as soon as practical doesn't mean they get to let them stay out there for any, you know, long period of time, or you do it when they feel like it. They have committed to and interpret it as that they have to go out there and they have to remove them. And I think the other big point is the fact that, you know, you're talking in the checkerboard, especially you're talking about areas you can't fence off. The wild horses on any given day are going to be on public and private lands. I don't even know if you could call them the fact that they're straying anymore. The fact that they will constantly be on private lands if you manage them on the public lands as well within the checkerboard. And then I'd also wanted to talk about kind of the natural balance of the horse population and just kind of emphasize the fact that, you know, wild horses in this area aren't being eradicated completely, as the wild horse groups kind of argue. There are horses remaining on White Mountain. There's horses remaining in Adobe Town. There's horses remaining in, which is another HMA in this area, is Colorado herd management area. They're not going away. Those populations and herds will still remain, and horses will still remain. And I can guarantee you they're probably still going to wander into the checkerboard. But, you know, they like the checkerboard, and that's where they like to be. With that, I want to give this time to the state, so I guess I will end it there. Thank you, Your Honors.
May it please the court, counsel, Greg Weiss of the Wyoming Attorney General's Office on behalf of Intervenor State of Wyoming. To answer a question from you, Judge Timkovich, how many horses will be left? The prior AML before this land use planning process was a range of 1,036 horses to 1,500 horses. The BLM's decision will leave anywhere from 45% to 56% of that AML in place, meaning that the decision leaves 464 to 836 horses in place in the planning area. To address the solid block public land issue, I believe raised by Judge Hartz, the focus of the BLM's analysis of that is because of a lack of separation between the solid block public lands area in the northern portion of the Great Divide Basin, HMA, and the southern portion of the Salt Wells Creek. The reality is there is no physical separation between the checkerboard and the solid block public lands. And the only way to manage the solid block public lands for wild horses would be by construction of some type of some obstacle, a fence, frankly, that could separate the solid block public lands from the checkerboard. And the BLM did look at that issue. And the BLM specifically found that construction of that fence over 100 miles in the Great Divide Basin HMA would negatively impact big game migration and sage-grouse movement. However, there was a portion of the Adobetown HMA that already has an allotment grazing fence, and the BLM did find that the solid block portion of that HMA can and will be managed for wild horses. But the simple reality is that the juxtaposition between the checkerboard and the solid block in those two HMAs, Great Divide Basin and Salt Wells Creek, prevents the use of those areas for management of wild horses. The state of Wyoming posits that this is not a case that turns on the outcome of the Wild Horse Act, but FLIPMA. FLIPMA recognizes, the courts have recognized the ability of the BLM to use the HMA process to determine how wild horses should be managed, and that's exactly what the BLM did in following the suggestion of Judge McKay. On behalf of the state of Wyoming, I appreciate the opportunity, unless there's any further questions.
Thank you. How much time? 4 minutes.
Hello again. I want to make a few brief points. First of all, here it's interesting that the Bureau of Land Management and the other respondents run away from the Wild Horse Act, the act that gave the protections to the specific category of wildlife at issue in this case. The district court did the same. The district court did not do any analysis under Loper-Bright as it's required to interpret and ultimately resolve a statutory interpretation question. This court has no such luxury. What the government argues and the other respondents is that, well, FLIPMA must do it. We can't point to anything in the Wild Horse Act that supports BLM's interpretation here because Congress never said BLM can do this in the Wild Horse Act. So they can't win at step one under the Wild Horse Act. So they point to FLIPMA. But FLIPMA is a generic land use planning statute. It does not override protections for wild horses any more than it does for bald or golden eagles under the Bald and Golden Eagle Protection Act. That is simply inconsistent with how you construe the laws, and that's in FLIPMA and its regulations. We've talked a lot about 3A today. I also want to point out another part of the Wild Horse Act that's really crucial, and that's Section 4. That's where Congress created the sole remedy for straying, and it gave private landowners the ability to notify BLM to have horses promptly arranged for removal.
So straying can't be considered in deciding what their boundaries are?
You've got it, Your Honor, because Congress devised, you have to look not just at the language of the act, but the structure of the act. And what Congress did in 1971 and amended again in 1978 and reaffirmed this is in Section 3A, which it labeled as the powers and duties carved out for BLM on the private lands. That's the title, powers and duties. It said nothing about private lands. It said nothing about addressing straying. And it dumped it into a second section, Section 4, and said that this is the one and singular remedy for this issue. It is not a relevant consideration as to the protection and management of wild horses on public lands. So here you have an agency that has improperly imported one consideration into a different part of the statute. And your sister court, the Ninth Circuit, said in Fellini that the prevention of straying is always subservient to the paramount mandate here to protect the wild horses on public lands.
But can BLM change its boundaries from time to time without violating the wildlife?
It may not remove the protections for a protected category of wildlife. That would be completely inconsistent with the statute, Your Honor.
the management areas? I mean, they are unsuitable for reasons. And
sure, yeah. So the West Douglas herd in Colorado and the Caliente Complex herd in Nevada, those are the two examples everyone here agrees were properly terminated. The protections were terminated because there was documented data and analysis showing that those areas were inhospitable to wild horse use because of a persistent lack of resources. That is the one basis Congress said you can remove these protections that we gave these horses, and that does not exist here. BLM's position is indefensible. It can't win at step one because it's not in the statute, and we would submit it as not the best reading, which is what the Supreme Court Chief Justice Roberts said in Loper Bright is the question now. Does the statute authorize it? Is this the best reading?
Now you've got a lot to try to get in.
I know, and Ms. Bess, I promised her I would give her a moment here.
Well, but, you know, I said at the outset, this is always problematic when you divide your time.
We're trying, Your Honor.
But I have a couple questions for you. One, you're saying that because Section 3 says you must remove them at the request of private property owners.
Section 4,
3A.
It's been a long argument day.
I actually knew that. I just misspoke. That because you must remove it in this circumstance, that means you have no discretion to remove it in any other circumstance? That strikes me as a strange way to read the statutory language.
Well, we cited a long line of Supreme Court cases in our opening brief, Your Honor, where that's exactly what the Supreme Court says. When Congress provides an exception or provides a specific remedy to a problem, agencies are not free to rewrite that or insert new exceptions or new remedies. And Congress, 54 years ago, said, we know horses will stray. It happens in pretty much every herd management area on a regular basis. This is not a unique situation. We pointed out examples in our briefs. And Congress said, we are not going to create these other opportunities like what BLM did here. It said, this is the answer.
I have a question. Let me ask you one Loper Bright question. Because the Supreme Court in Loper Bright said, prior precedent is not overturned by this. We're not going to re-examine all the precedent that relied on Chevron.
Sure.
Is there any controlling precedent here that you're challenging?
So in the AWHPC case where I successfully argued to the prior panel, that was under Chevron in a situation that was more favorable to agencies. So today, the situation, if anything, is actually better for plaintiffs, not agencies, because there's no thumb on the scale. Back then, the only question is,
but if it decided something, we're bound by the precedent decided.
Correct. So I would say the cases that have precedential value to this panel's decision here are, one, the Kleppe decision from the Supreme Court in 1976, which recognized the unequivocal mandate to protect and manage horses. This court's 1986 en banc decision in Mountain States Legal Foundation, which once again upheld the Wild Horse Act and its mandate, and then also the AWHPC decision from 2016. Thank you, Your Honor.
Be real quick.
Thank you, Your Honor. I just want to clarify one last point that Section 4 does provide the exclusive remedy, but also Section 3 also explains exactly what to do here. And it says that BLM must manage for a thriving natural ecological balance. And looking at those two sections is precisely what the 10th Circuit did in American Wild Horse Preservation Campaign versus Jewel. It recognized the practical realities that counsel talked about. And it said, even acknowledging that does not justify a departure from the clear language of the Act, which requires all wild horses to be protected for a thriving natural ecological balance and limits BLM's authority to remove that. By relying on a FLIPMA, they're essentially trying to void the entire Act, saying we can pick and choose where it applies. FLIPMA cannot be used for that. On its face, it says you must comply with other laws. The regulation says FLIPMA is subject to other laws, and past case law says it cannot overrule other laws. Thank you, Your Honors.
I hate to bring this to an end, but case is submitted, counsel excused, and we'll be in recess till 9 tomorrow morning.